getting a slightly late start. There was another meeting in here.
Okay.
It was Rolf's meeting, so I really had to yell at him hard.
It's hard to throw him out, huh?
Yeah. I got really irate and mad and jeopardized my career, basically. And, you know.
We're proud of you, Mark.
Okay. I'll post it on YouTube afterwards. Okay, I do not have Steve-O up, but Justin has already patched this in, so we're good there.
Justin must have it, so.
Yep. Okay, so let me see. Who's here? Sean. Sandy's here.
I'm here.
Simon, Benny. Sandy. Sean, Paul, Curtis, Justin, Kay, I guess. Is that Kay?
Kay's there.
And then at FSU, we have Aristides
and
Volker. And Volker? Okay. Okay, so I assume I'm going to run this thing. Unless you want to, Curtis, you can run the meeting.
You can have it, Mark. You can have it.
Okay, we have this argument every single time. Okay. So, so this is an agenda which I think I've seen before, actually. So let's go through it. Announcements of any kind? Well, yeah, I think most of these things have just come up naturally during the meeting. Okay, so agreed on parameters. This is a summary of stuff that we talked about last time. Sandy, do you have to go early today? Do we need to shift around agenda items?
If that works for you guys, that'd be great.
Yeah, Sandy has another thing from a long time before, and Well, let's go through the agreed on parameters because that should be quick, and then we'll look at the schedule and see where we can talk about anything that says JLab CC. Okay, so nominal goal is 10 billion events, 50 at BG Gen from 7 GeV to the endpoint, REST format for the output as usual. We may have some HDG on output. Why not? Okay, and also for the tape test, there's this idea of doing a test in the mode where we treat the HDG on output as raw data starting in the tape library, and then do a reconstruction step that way to simulate all the steps of all the data transfer of real data. Okay, target distribution, we thought we could handle that with existing software. SRM servers at UConn and Northwestern will receive grid events. Things are generated on the grid, and the SRM has to go out there and get them and bring them back to our disk space. JLab events written at JLab, CMU events written at CMU. Okay, is there any questions or amplifications on those quasi decisions that we made last time? Okay. All right. So let's see. JLab CC. So there were a couple of issues with the computer center that we need to discuss. In general, I think we've told them that we would start at the end of February here at JLab. We were told we could get, what, something like 1,200
The challenge is
nodes.
Cores, yeah.
Yeah, cores, right.
So the farm typically has about 1,400 cores, and for your data challenge, you guys are at, 1,250 cores. So it wouldn't be really a fair challenge if there were only 150 cores to do other work, obviously you'd have the whole farm. So we'll move like another 1,000 cores from Lattice so that the farm can kind of be the regular size and you know, what it would be in the at the 25% level. So you guys would have something like 1,250 out of 2,250 cores.
Okay, yeah.
And then the farm would just go back down to regular size after your challenge.
Yeah, so there's this nominal schedule that Chip and Graham agreed to about how much of a data challenge we need to do in advance of real data taking. And our next milestone is what you just said.
So 25%, yeah.
25%, which is 1250 cores?
Yeah. So basically it's 10% 2 years out, 25% a year and a half,
right.
50% a year out,
right.
And then work out all the kinks up in it. But so they, a year out, kind of sort of a halfway there run.
Okay.
And so that would include, you know, raw data coming over from the online systems, going to tape, whatever you need that you would be running simulations, whatever you would be doing running analysis, how much you need on work, volatile cash, what to expect there to make sure all the rates and all the flow
right.
work.
Right. Okay, and then another issue was the idea of trying to save end effects by scheduling it around a power outage.
Yeah, so facilities is scheduling a power outage of the whole data center in the next 6 to 8 weeks. So part of this, how you achieve the extra cores, is to use Lattice nodes. And so when we give the data challenge Lattice nodes, we just want to make sure that we do it in the time when you're ready to use them and that when you're done, we put them back. And so one option is, if you're done at the same time they do the power outage, then we'll just put them back in Lattice and they'll come up that way. But you thought that might not be the ideal way for you guys to run.
What we
were saying from what you said Graham and Chip had talked about and we forwarded on to
right.
your mailer or whatever is 3 to 5 days the right time frame? You know, is that what you need? How far do you want
right.
to ramp up?
So,
you can go all the way to 2,000 cores even if you want. So I guess we really need for you to tell us when and how much.
Well, let's see. 3 to 5 days does appear in that email message along with the milestone, things like that, for a data challenge. But the last one that we did, we ran
for two weeks.
And then we ran for several weeks before that just practicing.
Yeah.
So it was a multi-week exercise, say a month, you know, really, of usage in 2 weeks very intensively.
Very.
And so, and then there's lots of uncertainties on how much time.
So I guess the question is how much, at what level do you need all the 1,250 cores? The whole month, the whole, or 2 weeks, or 3 to 5 days? You just have to tell us.
I think the 2 weeks we're talking about were really intensive, and the rest, first practicing, we don't need to have the full bandwidth. I don't think. Although it would help certainly,
okay.
It doesn't hurt. You can iterate faster, you know, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So
we just need you to tell us that because we've heard out some suggestions. I think, and now you guys have to come back and say, no,
yeah,
we want longer, or we want it for yeah.
I think to say that we're going to do our data challenge in 3 to 5 days, though, is that's what's said on the thing, and I never objected to that piece of paper.
No, and I don't think that's that. We're just asking you how long do you need
right,
that much for.
Right, right.
And maybe you don't need all the lattice nodes the whole time. You get everything all worked out, and then you have the lattice nodes for 5 days or 2 weeks or a month. I don't know what that answer is.
Yeah, okay, so we'll have to go back and forth. I mean, our plans are not completely firm. Right now, either. So it's hard to say exactly what we're going to do.
I would just guess that it's probably the lattice nodes are needed for on the order of 2 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's just based,
based on
last
time.
You know.
So I don't know if people have seen the node flipping part of that. Probably most people know about how the nodes zip from the farm. Do you want me to explain that a little bit? Okay, so the way to get these lattice nodes when you need them for a short amount of time rather than having to, you know, scale up and then let them sit, is to borrow the ones from Lattice when you need them. And so in the meantime, while the farm hasn't been busy, Physics has put farm nodes into Lattice. And so if you go, I don't know who's sitting in front of a computer, but if you go to lqcd.jlab.org, you can see the farm nodes. If you click on nodes at the left, you can see the farm nodes that are actually in Lattice. And so right now it's 32 machines of the farm, 16 cores. So those have been there about, oh, I would say since the beginning of December. Can you?
Yeah.
I don't know how many people can see that, but if you look down at the bottom, the farm is 100% busy in Lattice right now. And so you're building up a credit so that when you get your nodes for 2 weeks, you will have already loaned some nodes, or less nodes probably. This is 32 nodes, and I think we're probably going to flip like 64 nodes to you guys to get all the cores you need. So maybe you loan 16 core machines to Lattice for a couple months, and then they loan you 64 back, plus you get your farm nodes back, and you use them for 2 weeks. And so it's sort of, we'll keep track of how it evens out in the end. Does that make sense?
Yep.
So while the farm's not that busy, Lattice is banking time so that when Lattice has to give up nodes for the data challenge, you guys have already built up a credit.
And this has already started happening, right?
Yeah, those farm nodes at the bottom of that Lattice page have been on loan to Lattice. Probably, I don't have it right in front of me, but like all of December and January, I'm almost positive. Because
okay.
You did it way before the holidays. So you banked all that time with them.
So we won't even basically use up all that time probably in this challenge.
Okay, maybe, yeah, and especially if you only go 5 days, probably not. Or, if you go 2 weeks, you'll use more. But you'll probably you'll definitely get your farm nodes back, and then I think it's going to end up being around twice that many nodes that Lattice is going to loan for the couple weeks. And
yeah.
See, then there will be time banked up when CLASP does it, because CLASP will run their 2-year 10% challenge sometime soon, too.
Mm-hmm.
The 2-year out challenge.
Yeah, 10%
is a lot.
I'm
not sure how many people had heard about that or had actually seen the moon sitting over in Lattice.
So, the other thing maybe to you is what sort of bottlenecks do you think might come up in this challenge with us running this much? We're writing to cache disk, we're reading it back in, and I guess our final output files are pretty small.
I'm not sure. I mean, did you guys see bottlenecks at the 10% level? Was there stuff we should be starting to look at? I mean, do you have enough disk space on work, cache, and volatile now?
I think for now,
Did you see bottlenecks at the 10%? Because we're not, we're basically going double that. So.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't expect.
Okay.
Bottlenecks, but I'm not saying there won't be any. I'm just not sure.
Yeah.
I don't know where to look right now, but
well, that's part of the reason we do these things is to find that too.
Yep.
Yeah.
And so when you tell us you're doing it too, I mean, you'll be a priority to be watching and tweaking and.
We were CPU limited. We were waiting for the job to finish. And so,
last
time.
Right. And so whenever the job finished, whatever we had to do with the files, there was plenty of time to do whatever you want with the files.
Yeah.
So there was no.
So last time you could have used more cores.
Yeah.
So.
Okay.
Completely limited by the CPU.
Okay, so this time, and I know we can give you more cores if you reach the 1,250 target and you want to see if you can go higher, then we can flip, 16 more nodes or 32 more nodes or whatever.
I wouldn't be adverse to pushing it as far as we can get it, even if it's just for a couple of days.
Okay.
I mean, I think that would help us all if we knew that. Early.
Yeah, we just want to be watching it and So what we can do is just, if you see like you're starting to reach 1,250 and it's a piece of cake and you want more,
yeah.
The main thing that we have to do is let some jobs drain to get you a free node. And so...
Yeah, I mean, I think the only, if CPU, if you had infinite CPU, I think the main bottleneck would be reading the raw data off of the tape library, because that's the big data. You know, that's the big data.
So saying it came online, you stored it on tape, and now you want to bring it back into process?
To process it. I think that's the possible bandwidth bottleneck, and that's the thing that we haven't even explored yet.
Okay.
Okay, so we haven't even touched that.
We'll be watching and, you know, ready to understand or help or fix or whatever.
Right, because that's when the data has the biggest volume, obviously.
Yeah, and we have to write that data to tape in the near future.
Right, so that goes back to that other exercise of doing exercise off the raw data, where the raw data is in advance on tape.
Yeah, so during the two-week run, you know, presumably you're keeping the tape drives busy with what would be raw data. So you're constantly streaming raw data from the online system, and then you're reading back in what you need for processing. So you may have...
I don't think we'll be using the tape drives much this one. Okay. We don't have the raw data there. We'll be basically generating...
I think you want to put something there that looks like raw data, right? I mean, you want that to be part of your process, even if it's not real raw data, right?
Well, that was a follow up after this to make sure we can just keep up with the data that we've got. At least we had broken this into two pieces because we have to simulate that data and stop it at the raw data stage in simulation and then write it to the tape library and then set up something that just reads that in. And I don't. We're not ready for that one at this point.
No, I think it's not.
Okay, so yeah, Mark, if you're going to send us like a summary of all this, when you're going to do it, and we're going to test to say that you're not going to do that part this time, I guess.
Well,
it would be good if you could, but if
exactly.
It's not ready, you're not.
I mean, we probably won't. We might try to do that in some other limited fashion later on. Again, depends on when the components become ready.
Okay.
But for right now, it looks like we're going to do the same style. For the most part, the same style that we did last time, which means we generate the data on the job itself,
mm-hmm.
Okay, and then reconstruct it. Okay, so there's no data coming in, right? The job itself makes its own data and then reconstructs it, and then we throw away the data that it made because we're really more interested in the reconstructed result. So in that mode, there's no flow in, and so there's no bandwidth. Requirement.
Yeah, but then it's not a true test from start to finish, right?
I mean, right, that's correct.
Okay. I mean, yeah, whatever
that's
you're
correct.
Ready for,
that's correct.
And then the other question is the SRM piece, is that needed? Is there something different this time that was needed that was not needed in the 10% run?
I think if we had what was in the 10% run, we'd be good at this point.
Okay. I mean, I assume you do, but there was then the further question.
Well,
is
I think we're still having a hard time understanding this.
We
would like to copy data from that's done on the grid, copy it here. Okay, at a minimum. And that was, in Richard's email, that was sort of the easy part. He said. Although, I don't know that we've ever done that.
I don't know that we've done that.
And I don't know.
I don't know.
And I don't know if that capability is still
alive.
Somebody's got a mic on that's
echoing. Yeah, I don't know if you can hear me or not. I'm just testing.
Yeah. Yep. I can hear you now. Okay.
Is that you, Richard?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I was just going to say that the easy part is allowing people that live at Jefferson Lab to move data from, say, CMU to UConn. That's the easy part. So it's the client that allows people from JLab to, say, move data around on the grid off-site. What doesn't work is moving it on-site.
So we would like, I think that would be a capability that we would really like. Because we're the only institution that has a large tape facility. Okay, so if we want to archive any of these results, we've got to copy it here, one way or the other. And so And the question is, how do we want to do that? SRM was our default solution for that. And then as soon as we start talking about SRM, I'm starting to lose contact with exactly what the details are and what's working, what's not, who's responsible, and so on. So, I mean, we have to work that out. Now, what I heard Richard say was the SRM will work from here as long as we're going from, you know, Northwestern to UConn. Which is kind of cool, you know. That's good. But that's not really what the you know, staff here is interested in doing, right? So we'd like to have at least a capability of pulling data from the outside into the lab, if not pushing it out as well. I think that's kind of and that's a fundamental requirement, right, for running this experiment at some point. And this is a good time as any to get that going. It's getting kind of late, actually. So, I mean, I just got that what we can do is move data around on the outside. I never knew that before. Now, just now. So, I don't know. How do we approach this? We keep circling around this issue when we don't get
to any particular. I think over the next 6 months or so, we have to address it. I think it shouldn't be one of the milestones to doing this data challenge, because I think the data can perfectly safely sit wherever it's produced. And I'd rather really, I would like to have us have a discussion at the collaboration meeting about what we really do require, so that we're not asking for unreasonable things also.
Well, it's true that, I mean, that was the key statement. The data can sit on disk safely for quite a while, okay? So the need isn't outside. So the need is not, the need can be, the facility can be pushed off a little bit, okay? It doesn't have to happen right now to make this data challenge succeed. I agree, I totally agree with that.
And it probably would help to quantify how much data you're talking about moving in and out.
So our estimate is with the 10 billion events that we probably four times the, it's like, what, 40 terabytes, we're guessing?
Yeah, something like 40 terabytes. And that's not outlandish, I don't think.
Yeah.
No, the 10 gig pipe, I mean, you can move that around.
Yeah.
Pretty easily.
I think you're going to be limited by what's on the other end of that pipe, probably.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So it's not. We would write a lot of it to tape. We wouldn't have to keep it all spinning at the same time either.
Yeah.
Here. So it's well within, you know, scope of what you guys are capable of doing. Right. I think.
I think our long term, I think the only place that's really going to have the raw data, which is going to be the petabyte type footprint, is never going to leave JLab. And when we get it down to our REST format, which is the data that goes outside to do physics, that is substantially smaller. That's tens of terabyte type, maybe 100 terabyte type footprint,
mm-hmm.
and on a high intensity year.
All right, so I guess we have to talk about that later again.
But I'd like us to have a discussion on that too. Yeah, just to make sure we need to know what we're asking for too.
Okay. So I think that's
the collaboration.
It's 2 weeks.
Yeah, February 22nd, I believe.
Here,
yeah.
That session on a weekday?
The offline session is on, I think it's Friday afternoon.
At the end of February?
It's 22nd or something.
February 21st, I think. 22nd is a Saturday.
So probably Friday afternoon.
Yeah. That's consistent with my memory of it. Okay, so I think that hits all the, you know, computer center centric topics
okay.
for now. So, but thanks
yeah.
for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's go back to status of preparation. Item 3, first bullet is phi equals 0. Any update on that? Or so Simon did send a report to Richard, I understand.
I sent a plot to Richard, yeah. Richard's online, right?
I think he is, yes.
Yeah.
I have no update on that. Benny confirmed that it appears to be a problem with seeing the stereo straws.
Yeah.
It's a really weird behavior because I did generated Geontinos and just run the Geontinos at 90 degrees through the CDC, and at 0 degree phi, everything looks... And I changed the wall thickness of the straws to lead so that when the Geontino flies through, it sees those lead pretty well. So you have, and when you run at phi equals 0, I see all these spikes where each straw is.
So it's a lead pipe chamber.
Right. And then I changed the phi to just a little bit off to 3 degrees, and all of a sudden all stereo angles, all stereo straws are not there anymore. It's really weird. So I then actually also looked in the geometry itself by plots in with 4++. And using Richard's code WC.QMUC.F to actually pick at the individual volumes, and there I see really weird behavior. That I don't even see the straight straws there sometimes, which is also weird. Right?
Yeah.
But I haven't seen problems of the straight straws.
Not if I can speak or not.
Is that you, Richard?
I can hear you.
Yeah, that was me trying to speak.
Okay, you can speak now.
Okay,
speak now.
Okay, if you're having trouble using that WC interface, I can help you with that. It always gives me consistent results.
Okay, I will send you what I have.
But the result that I get is these. Right at the transition between 359 degrees and 0 degrees, where it wraps around, there are straws that are still being missed. And you can reproduce that either by tracking or just by clicking on the WC interface that you described.
Uh-huh.
So we had snow, so I've been just trying to keep up with classes. And I hope that we get back, working again soon.
Okay, well, the news there, then, is
we
see the problem.
You've
been able to reproduce the problem, Richard. Is that correct?
Yes. That's right.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay. So let's go on. Random number seeds. Mark hasn't done anything on this. Anyone?
I don't think anyone's done anything.
Yeah. Okay. So then let's go on. Electromagnetic background. Do you want to lead this, or Paul, do you want to? Paul, take it away.
Kay's got some slides, but I don't, so I'll just be real quick. And then I ran some tests here just to see if I can get everything working. I updated to the software that you sent out, Mark, the versions. And if I run jobs with the electromagnetic background at the 10 to the 7 level, if I run jobs that are just 1,000 events each, a third of them crash. And this is where I'm assigning 2.5 gigs of RAM. So it looks like in some of these that the FCC is getting lit up like a Christmas tree, but I haven't compared that in detail with not electromagnetic running. Some of these crashes are not I try reproducing the crashes on my local machine instead of the job clusters, and sometimes it crashes and sometimes it doesn't. So I'm not sure what's happening. Maybe Kay has a more detailed things, but I'm having serious problems here.
Where does it crash on
these? You say crash. Do you mean a seg fault or do you mean an MZ book fatal? Said fatal.
Sometimes it's just in a. Let me see.
Check the log file.
So, bad alloc a lot.
In HT Jant or in Jana?
Wire based tracking, so it's probably in the Kalman filter, I suspect. I haven't done a detailed look to see if that's what's happening every time, but it seems to be most of the time.
That's in reconstruction then, not in simulation.
I don't think it's in simulation. I think it's reconstruction.
Every time it's crashing, it's in reconstruction somewhere in the tracking.
It's just, there's a huge number, presumably there's a huge number of track candidates being found with the background on.
That could be, but I don't have details yet. Kay probably has more, but that's my experience.
I think we've really got to fix that before we run the challenge.
Yeah. That's pretty clear. Jay, do you have anything?
So on my side, I sent around the PDF file on the offline email list, and I also was able to update the wiki. So if you just refresh your browser, you'll see that I linked the file there. So this isn't going to take a long time. I can just summarize some of the things that I found. So in my case, I don't specify any kind of memory use in the cluster, so I didn't have any of those issues that Paul had. So just go on to slide two. These are the basic settings that I use just to make sure that I'm on page with everybody else. So hopefully all of these parameters make sense. So for BGJAN, I have to set the photon energy limits, the electron peak, and the electron energy. So these probably are pretty good. So we can just go on to slide three. So slide three is where the electromagnetic background comes in. So this is the control.in file for HDJAN. And what I did was I put in these two parameters, BG rate and BG gate. So according to the standard control.in file within the HDJAN directory, 10 to the 7 photons per second corresponds to what I call the standard setting. So that's a BG rate of 1.10. I don't know what the units are. And BG gate is set to minus 200 to 200. So I ran five different sets. So all of the original input HDJAN files are the same. The only difference is how they're processed in HDJAN with this control.in file. So there's one that's without the electromagnetic. One is with the standard. I also tried one with a very high rate, so five times the photon or the background rate. So that's 5.5. I call that the high rate. I also tried to change the gate, so that's set to minus 400 to 400. Then I also did one final one with both the high rate and the long gate.
Just for reference, the one that I used for my crashes was the standard setting that Kay is showing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so if you're having problems with that one, then you probably can't go to the high rate because I think that probably uses a lot more memory. So I can show that in the next slide.
Now, Kay, can you say what does the BG gate mean?
I believe that this is some kind of gate time in nanoseconds for when to include the background. So
yeah.
This is like plus minus 200 nanoseconds around the incoming photon time. Is that correct?
I can answer that. So BG gate starts at the trigger time and goes back 200, whatever, however many nanoseconds you go, and starts generating beam photons from the radiator and just letting Jaon track them all the way down through the photon beam line through the collimator and down to the target, and any interactions that are intrinsic to Jaon will be generated as it goes through the target. And it does that, and it generates random in time, according to an exponential distribution for the spacing between them, according to an average rate given by BG rate in gigahertz, until it expires at the end of the other end of the BG gate.
Okay.
Is that clear?
Okay. Yeah, it is. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Richard. So going on to slide 4, so this just shows what kind of processing time it took and also the file sizes. So usually when I run BGGen without any kind of background, it usually takes less than 2 hours. So if something's running for more than 2 hours, then I know that something's wrong. So that's like my sort of standard time. So I thought the whole this whole thing would take less than a day or so. But it turned out with the rates turned on, the background turned on, there's a lot more processing time. Mm-hmm. So the final file sizes are not too different. So you can see that for the files without background, it's 21 to 22 megabytes, and at the most, I only get 27 or so. So the increase in file size is not too much, but the amount of time it takes is actually very, very different. So you can see that, for example, if I try the standard, then that doubles the amount of time it takes to process one file. And if I go to the high rate, it's about 3 times more than that. So it takes like 10 hours just to process 10,000 events.
How much of this time is in JSON?
So most of the processing time is taken up by HDJSON. So
okay.
I think just because of all of the different photons coming in. So for
okay.
example, I have at the very bottom bullet with the high rate going on, I think 7 hours out of the 10 is used up by HDJSON. So what I'm seeing right now is that the penalty really comes in the processing time, not the file sizes.
Yeah.
And a lot of it is really in HDJSON. Then on slide 5, I just have...
Sorry. So does HDJSON, does the time really just scale like the integrated, or the rate of the BG rate? So is like the HDJSON time for standard and high rates a factor of 5?
No, because you have the original particles from the event, and then on top of that, you're adding in the background. So maybe if I had a few more data points, we could try to see if there's any kind of linear relationship. But right now,
it is linear with an offset, as you say.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So on slide 5, I just have 3 plots that I made. So the first one on the top left. This corresponds to the number of showers that were found. So there's a black histogram hidden in there somewhere. Then on top of those, I have the different background settings. So you can see that with the highest setting of the highest rate and the maximum gate time, that's the magenta one. That corresponds to more photons found per event.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you look at the top right, that's the total energy that was deposited within the FGAL. So for each shower, I loop over them. And what I do is I check whether or not the detector that found that shower was the FGAL. And in that case, I fill this histogram with the total energy that was deposited. So you can see that the increase in the energy in the FGAL is pretty substantial. So you see that compared to the standard one without any background, that's the black one at the bottom. You can see that there's like maybe 3 times more events that have a deposit of like, say, 200 MAB or so. Then the bottom is for the BGAL.
I suggest that you make a time cut on that because the FCAL has very good timing and you should
sure.
only like integrate around the trigger, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't have any kind of cut on that. So that's something I could look in the next round of analysis.
Yeah.
And the final slide is for the BGAL deposited energy. So you can see that in that case, of course, the probably most of the background is just going down the beam line. So there's really no increase in the background. Or sorry, the BCAL energies.
Did you have any information on tracks, numbers of tracks? Or?
I can look into that next.
Okay.
Yeah, it took a lot longer than I thought it would to just process
yeah.
these events. I think some of these files were like running until this morning, so it took like 2 full days just
yeah.
to get this done. So.
What was your crash rate?
So on slide 4, I have a column for small file sizes. So out of 200 or so files, I usually find only like 1 or 2. And then for whatever reason, for the high rate one, I had 8 or so files that had a small file size.
Okay.
Okay.
That's good.
Using the same. Sorry, was this the same version of the code that Paul was using?
No, not quite.
Yeah, but I updated my trunk like 2 days ago, so it should be pretty similar, I think.
Well, we're running different versions of Jana, for example, or using patch 1.
Okay, yeah.
You're using
patch 1. I could try updating Jana, see if that makes a difference.
If you would switch to what Mark put out yesterday,
yeah,
and see if it changes or not, that would... then I could see if it's a problem just on my end or if it's something with the code.
Yeah. Okay. I'm seeing the same problem as Paul, I think. With that
you code. See the same problem?
Yeah, I made a little wiki page with some notes on it. I linked it sort of farther down in the agenda, so we'll get to that.
Okay.
All right, Kay, good. That's very nice. That's interesting.
Yeah, so I can send around a few updated slides maybe later on in the next few days, I guess.
Is there any way that you can figure out how much memory your jobs are getting on your cluster, Kay? I mean,
I can try to look into that. I know for sure that it's not in the log files, but maybe I can ask around and somebody will know that where I can get that information. I could also just log into the machines while they're running and just try to just do a top or something and figure out that way.
We have, what, like 16 gig on some of our cluster nodes, but we just be limiting it to the number.
We have eight. You bring out a gig of core.
So, but I think I think the red queue, we have 2 gigs or 4.
Yeah, that was filled up some guys doing a PWA
when
I was going. I can get more. Just when I was...
Yeah, okay. It might be interesting just to ratchet that up and see how much we have to go to with this.
So, Kay, when you say 21811 for small files, that's out of how many, again?
That's 200 each.
200 each. So, 2 represents 1% then, in other
words. Yes.
Wow, that's not bad. I mean, it's not good, but it's not too bad.
Okay. Yeah.
It would be... Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. This is useful to start seeing this.
Well, you got to run, otherwise you never figure it out.
Right.
Well, since we're on this topic, why don't we skip ahead and then move back?
Okay.
So the 100 job test, the last bullet, 100 job test of various sizes, a JLab link there. And if you click on that, here are sort of my notes. As Paul mentioned, the first bullet has a link to here, which is the versions that I chose. I chose these versions for SimRecon and HDDS to be just before some recent changes to the time of flight geometry, a particular revision, which I put in the email message. So this is what we're standardizing on.
Why do you want to do it before the time of flight change?
Because at the time I was tagging it, there were some questions about whether it was working. In fact, I'm pretty sure it was screwed up.
quick questions about your settings, Mark. On your data challenge page that has all the settings, your control.in does not have the background in. Is that what you ran these tests at without the electromagnetic background?
Yes. Yes,
okay.
It was. So basically, I didn't fool with any of the settings, really. I just used the same settings we used last time for the last data challenge. I just took them straight across and didn't fool around with anything, just to see if I could get the jobs to submit and run. I mean, that was the basic goal. So going back to the notes page then, submitted 1,000 jobs, 50,000 events per job. We hit a peak on the farm of 850 jobs around 11 o'clock last night and held there at 850 till about 4 this morning. When I did this accounting, 900 of them had finished. And then these categories were things that appear in the standard output file. Okay? I assume that they're bad if they're in the standard output file, and they sound bad. You can see that a lot of the things. So the success was really a very tiny standard output file with just some benign message in it.
So what's an exception? What does it mean?
Okay. So exception caught for thread. You get Jana saying that it's gonna. Sometimes it does says this, and sometimes it doesn't. It says that a thread died, and it's not going to restart it. You know, it's going to kill the job. Sometimes you get a core dump, and sometimes you don't. Okay, so this is done very quickly. What you'll also notice is that they don't add up to 100%, because I think some of these messages are show up in more than one file, some overlaps. Okay, but they're roughly. I mean, this gives you a feeling for what the thing is.
The second line for the filter is a debug message. You tell me which line to look at, so that's why I put those messages in.
Okay.
It shouldn't be fatal.
Okay.
I have to look at that.
But it's only 20 events.
Yeah.
So it's insignificant. While the jobs were killed, that's second significant.
Okay, now, the 221 jobs killed from memory, I had, I forgot to write this down, it was 1.5 gigabytes of memory I requested.
So it blew up.
Blew up.
The memory blew up.
Memory
That's
blew
my
up.
Last data challenge, 1.5 gigs.
Right, so that was the setting that I had from last time. I just went straight through, you know. I didn't change anything, right? And so that seems to be a little bit too small now.
Which is a bit disappointing, because it should have, meanwhile, it should have been investigated. We cannot keep the same errors from one challenge to another challenge. Otherwise, why do we need this challenge?
Well, we went through an exercise of trying to address a lot of these errors, and we really thought we had them.
Yeah.
Have them tamped down. The other thing is that this thing was tagged yesterday, and it could be that there's something inconsistent with that tag. In other words, maybe the tag itself may be capturing pieces of software that shouldn't be in there at the same time. You know, like the time of flight, but I think I avoided the time of flight. You know, I could have also, you know, fumble fingered it too, and maybe I tagged a slightly wonky version. So That all has to be checked.
Okay.
So this is, and I'm presenting it because that's what happened, right? So this is, but it's consistent with what Paul's seeing, that he gets a lower rate of job crashes, but he also gets it with smaller number of events per job. So.
I had with different software than you specified, because this was before or just right after you sent it out.
Yes.
I was getting every job, almost every job crashed when I limited it to 2 gigs of RAM. But when I opened it to 2.5, a lot more went through. Or certainly from 1.5 to 2.5, a lot more went through.
Right.
So maybe that's part of it.
Yeah, I mean, another thing vis-a-vis the last challenge is that, 1.5 was a good number. That allowed most of the job, you know, very high, if not 100% success rate, based on the memory alone, right? And now the software has shifted since then.
So is there, just for my understanding,
sure.
So this VMAIL, is it produced by some new or whatever is the memory, malloc and memory allocation, or it is just a crash? Because it allocated the memory, it went beyond something.
It's the batch system itself, watching the job and seeing how much memory it's using up.
But what about the programs themselves? Do they check that there is enough memory when they try to allocate more?
No.
Well, potentially it can blow up to anything. So it's a bit bizarre, because you have to, I suppose, if at some moment when it tries to allocate, it should decide maybe it is unreasonable to allocate that, and that will kill these events.
Well, there may be things that do that, but I've never heard.
Used to do all this,
right.
So they just do not, not indefinitely.
Can I suggest that the shell has a tool called ULimit that you can use to set the limit on two critical things. The first is total virtual size is what you're discussing right now, and something that's more tied to physical memory, which is the resident set. And we need to monitor both of those because the resident set can be more critical because it's tied more to physical memory, whereas the virtual memory, I've got a job running right now that's got 85 gigabytes of virtual memory, and it runs just fine in a 2-gigabyte machine.
Okay, and where is that? Where do you get that? Can you repeat where that comes from? I mean, the software to monitor that?
Yeah, the shell in which it runs, if you're running using Bash or a lookalike, it just type ULimit minus A, and it lists all the limits, and those are sort of job resource limits, how many open files simultaneously, how much virtual memory maximum, how much residence that the job is allowed to have, et cetera.
Well, that's in the shell itself? Richard, is that the shell itself, or is that something you run underneath?
Yeah, that's right. It's a built-in ULimit.
Okay.
But in general, this, as far as I understand, this type of data analysis, the full memory, even the virtual, should be limited. You cannot go beyond something. And if it's accumulated, if there's a memory leak, it's a good indication that the memory grows. It's just a memory leak. It's a poor programming. I mean, it's a bug in the code, which should be fixed.
Exactly.
Right. The maximum virtual memory is limited by the swap file. So, you cannot have 5 petabytes of virtual memory.
Right. So it is absurd. So it is, you cannot go to these big numbers. That means that the code is faulty. But the main thing is the first line. This is twice bigger, so that's the main thing to address at the moment.
Yeah, I think part of it may be that we're now killing the things. This is speculation on my part, but we're now killing jobs when a thread goes offline, whereas before we were starting them up automatically. And I think that practice could potentially have hidden some of these problems.
In my opinion, it's much worse because it is not really when the memory blows up. It's your problem. So you, unless you're lazy, you should be able to fix that.
Right.
But the first one is something with maybe something has to do with the with this I don't know thread allocation of the particular operating system, and that sounds sinister. I don't know that if it is real, and it is a very big. It's half of the.
Yeah. No, it's huge. It's huge. So something is clearly wrong. But remember that at this point, we have to make sure that we're not just.
A lot of the tests that we did leading up to this were done by Kay at IU, and he doesn't seem to have memory problems. He seems to have more memory available. So. I don't know if that may just be a red herring right now.
Or it could be David released a new version of JANA. Maybe it's perfectly fine, but maybe there's an additional bug or two that we might be hitting.
Look at it. Yeah. We could speculate forever. For example, the VMEM, it could be if I go from 1.5 to 2.5, as Paul did, then everything, then they go away.
Yeah.
Or it could be that they keep crashing when they hit 2.5, right? And then you really do have a problem.
Well, you
still have to see.
Yeah.
You add some another routine or some another process, and they will overpass 2.5. So it is a perpetual thing unless you address the core of the problem, that it's a memory leak, for example.
Exactly. So it could be that raising the limit does nothing to solve the problem, right?
Yes.
Absolutely. But we have to see.
That's why we started running all these jobs everywhere, too. I'm just surprised that it's this bad.
It was very surprising. And the jobs ran, I didn't get a good look at the CPU. The jobs ran something between 6 to 8 hours.
But
and some and the miracle is some succeeded. You know,
can you reproduce these crashes, or it is impossible?
We just,
that would be helpful.
I submitted them yesterday at dinner time, and we had done all these tests all along, and
your mini data challenges, Mark, you were running, didn't show this.
Yeah.
So
like we need to revert back to a code similar to what Kay ran and just test to see what it was there.
Yeah.
Right. So the other thing is, but I wanted to show this.
This is good. I mean, this we have to go through this. And this is the first time we've hit multiple sites with the code with lots of jobs all at once. Unfortunately, everything was done yesterday. So all we see is results. We haven't had a chance to digest it and figure out what possible underlying causes are.
Okay. Let's go back onto the agenda. Under three, the fourth bullet is okay, so obviously we gotta go through and fine tooth comb one by one, deal with all these
issues.
Can you
send me the stack traces?
Yeah, I have all the log files and everything. I mean,
I volunteered to run Valgrind.
That would be a smart thing too.
We should look at the tagging point too. That it's a reasonable place to tag. I just made a guess, kind of, after I saw Benny's changes and went right after them, and so I may have caught something in between set of changes. Okay, so I'm sorry. So event genealogy, Kay, did you get a chance to look at that at all?
I haven't looked at it yet. I'll try to go through it in the next round.
Okay, very good. So stay on the action item list. Bullet 5 is JLab CC. We had the discussion with Sandy. Bullet 6 is preparation of standard distributions and scripts. Well, I distributed something, and it may not have been the right thing. But we have the mechanism is there.
Yeah.
Paul was able to grab the versions, it seems like, as he did last time. So that looks reasonable.
Paul said that there might be a difference due to Jaina, what is the difference between my Jaina 0.7.1 and the new patch? Does anybody know?
I was just guessing that could be a cause, so I don't really know what the difference is. It may not be, but it would be interesting to see if you changed whether things started crashing for you or not.
Yeah, because when I updated my stuff like a few days ago, the patch thing did not exist. And I look at the Jaina webpage now, and they just updated on February 4th. So I'm wondering like what happened, you know, in between the 1 week that you know they put out 0.7.1 and the patch.
I don't think we're going to figure it out in this meeting.
Okay, so next last bullet is Sean. Sean has some slides on data management.
Yeah, it's more along the lines of notes, more or less, because I guess at the last meeting, Richard asked me to look at what some of the data management practices were used by other experiments to see if, you know, maybe there was some software or something that we could use to keep track of all the files that we're creating, since, I mean, it's going to be thousands and thousands. So what I did is that I tried to look through all the publicly available information that I could, and unfortunately, you know, there wasn't always that much that you could get, but generally I saw a lot of different approaches. But you could kind of boil them down to two main ones. So to keep track of all the files that were created, the first one was some sort of custom database. And then the files were then accessed by XRootD or SRM. And so it seemed like a lot of experiments were moving towards at least access. So on the back end, they would have some various solution that was, you know, better or less documented to move data around using SRM. and then you'd have some read-only access on the front end via XRootD. So that's the nice thing about that is that XRootD has a the capability to provide you can have multiple layers of these things, and so if you have one main node that you access everything through, then it kind of gives you a consistent namespace to access all the files. And so so Alice has been using that for quite a long time. It seems like a lot of the next generation work done by CMS and Atlas are moving that area. Unfortunately, a lot of that work is still ongoing. So there's a lot of small different, you know, pieces of software that seemed interesting, but a lot of that work was sort of manpower intensive, so not really applicable to what we did or what we want to do. The other really common thing that I saw was they have this Dirac.
Sean, can you summarize what XRootD is?
Sure. Yeah. So it's kind of a quick, lightweight file access protocol. So originally it was developed by the people at Slack for Babar in terms of so to give you a consistent and fast way to access data over a cluster. And so now people are moving that, you know, to access data not only in the local you know, in one site, but you can also do it on multiple sites. The basically the way that works is that you have one node that works as sort of a redirector, and that can actually have multiple different layers. And so what they do is that kind of gives you the namespace, and it figures out where the files are actually stored on the actual data storage nodes. So you can think of, so it's a, kind of a lazy evaluation in that case. And so the idea is that there it goes through, and it you know, kind of matches your job with the actual server that the data is sitting at. That's kind of the quick explanation.
Okay.
Yeah, just one thing to add to that is that it only works for root files.
I don't think that's the case. Because what a lot of people...
Yeah, that's correct. It only works for root files because the open command, the whole XRootD protocol, like open the command and then find a certain object. Root files act like object repositories, and the whole protocol is based upon give me an object, name this, and stuff. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that wasn't really the impression that I got, but I mean, we can talk about that later. Anyway, to keep on going on, so another really common thing that I saw was the Dirac toolkit, which was originally developed for LHCb. I know that Bess and Bell are using it, and so it has sort of this metadata database and file catalog, and it has all the tools for managing data like this, but it's also a full set of grid middleware, because all these experiments are at the size where they run on all, you know, multiple different national grids, and you know they have all these other concerns to deal with, and so I don't know if that software is really decouplable from that toolkit. So I guess the summary for that is that, you know, there, you know, this is what I saw of the different approaches that were used, but I don't know if there's any, you know, anything out there that's at least easily applicable to our situation. You know, so maybe this is something that we want to think about having ready for the next data challenge, but not this one, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, in slide two, you're just doing a survey?
Yeah,
that's just some of the notes. It's not a comprehensive list, but, if people are interested, that's some of the details about the different experiments, some of the different experiments I looked at, not all of them.
Should we go and explain the acronyms one by one? No, let's not do that.
Yeah.
Ice pod. They need an ice pick is what they need. Okay. Well, that's helpful, although disappointing, I would say. Are there comments or questions for Sean or thoughts in this area? People want to talk about?
I just want to correct what I said earlier. I just looked up, and Slack now has a Fuse-based sort of API layer on top of X3D that allows you to store non-root objects, you know, as if they were root, you know, inside X3D and hide the fact that they're non-root. I don't know how performant that is, but in principle, it is possible to push things into X3D that aren't root, hide the fact that they're not root.
Okay, well, thanks. That gets
okay, well, good. Thanks. That gets us thinking.
Okay.
Justin has some remarks.
Justin has some
on
remarks.
Stuff they're doing at MIT.
Yeah, I brought this up with Martin Curtis this week.
Richard, can you mute, please?
Sorry.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Okay. So we have this small cluster with a few people at MIT working on it.
No, we're still echoing.
Okay, that could be me, maybe.
Okay.
Is that any better?
Yeah, they're stopped.
Yeah. Okay.
It's weaker, yeah.
Okay. So basically what we're doing is they've developed a cluster which is pretty modest in size, but it's developed on this what they call OpenStack, which is sort of a cloud-based computing platform, where the idea is that you make the cluster very generically accessible to basically anyone who has a virtual machine image that they can launch and start a process in. And so it's really just started sort of getting off the ground, and the guy who's sort of managing this is sits across the hall from me. So he's asked me to test some things with some of our software, and I've run the GUIX software on virtual machines running on the system, and it looks like it works pretty well with, you know, sort of just like 5% differences between running in this virtual machine mode as opposed to actually installing it on the node itself and running the processes.
Mm-hmm.
From the perspective of MIT and the people sort of running this, they'd like to have a test of this system, and I proposed to them that we could include it as part of our data challenge to sort of utilize a bulk of this cluster for a couple weeks and sort of as a test of their cluster. For us, it adds a little bit of, from the GUIX side, it adds a little bit of computing power. It's not, you know, a big factor compared to what we hope to get from the grid. But it also explores this idea of virtualization, which was brought up in the software review, and so has just sort of adds an extra component to the data challenge. So this is sort of a proposal, and I'm not really asking for anything from JLab or anyone, but just asking if we can sort of add this CPU power to this part of the challenge.
I think it'd be a great idea to try it.
So assuming that this works, what would be like the full-scale implementation?
It's not really known yet. So right now I put this, you see under the bullet, we use cluster specs. We have 22 blades with 8 cores each. And right now these are all blades that are recycled from other clusters at MIT. So we have this sort of recycling program where when somebody gets done with a piece of hardware, they just send out an email, and if you want it, you can claim it. And so we've been sort of starting to collect these, and they're coming in at, like, you know, 5 or 6 blades per month with no real expected end in sight. So it could, you know, sort of keep growing. There's really no particular funding for this at all yet. So if we got to a point where it was being viable, we could look for, you know, expanding it even larger. But for right now, it's not a big scale thing, but more of a testing the environment. Say one other thing in terms of the sort of cloud idea, and just looking around at what some of the other people are doing.
You got to hear that. I'm sorry.
At the LHC, they've converted a couple of their online trigger farms to sort of cloud-type spaces where they can essentially, without doing anything to the hardware or software installed in the nodes, they just add this cloud infrastructure, and they can run simulation and reconstruction jobs on their trigger farms when they're not collecting data. So this is sort of a simple implementation of sort of switching an entire cluster to running completely different software without actually ever changing anything on the nodes themselves. So it opens up some other possibilities if people are interested in that.
So Justin, can we mine bitcoins on this farm? See, they laugh.
I think it's
completely useless, right?
To be able to keep up.
I have a question. When you have 160 of these machines, how are you going to manage them? Do you plan to install some kind of a batch system on it, or just integrate it into the grid?
So far we haven't implemented any kind of a batch system. In principle, you can set up a Condor site to sort of distribute the jobs among them. But for right now, I mean, for this challenge, we're basically utilizing the whole thing. And so with just some simple Eucalyptus tools, you can launch your virtual machine instance over a whole node and basically just run flat out on all the nodes. So for right now, since we're the lone user, we don't really need much of a batch system.
Well, but I mean, once your virtual machine is up, it's just like booting a computer. Now you need some kind of a job submission scheme and something to collect the results, right?
Well, so the way it works now is with these Eucalyptus tools, you can inject, they call it injecting a batch script, or a bash script, sorry. So you basically just, you launch the node, it starts up, and then at boot time, once everything's prepared, it runs the script that you told it to. So I will tell it to run 8 parallel jobs and loop over certain random number seeds to generate X number of data files. And then after that dies, I can launch another virtual machine which does the same thing. So right now it's a by-hand type of thing. But and we certainly, if it's scalable, we'd like to make it more, you know, interactive in the future.
Mm-hmm. Take advantage of what Mark is doing with scripts rather than writing all your own. It just sounds like a big repetition of work.
I wrote most of it in a couple hours yesterday, so it seems like it's working, you know, with this small scale, it's not too hard.
Okay, that's interesting. So that means the uptime for the machine is the same as the length of the job. It just wakes up, does the job, and then shuts down.
Well, I mean, that or you can just launch it and say, let the virtual machine run for a week, and produce however much you can in that amount of time, and then shut it down later. So it's you can, in principle, you could launch the virtual machine and have it iterating on, you know, a set of random number seeds as long as the cluster doesn't lose power.
You
don't necessarily have to launch a virtual machine per job.
I see. Okay. You set it on an infinite loop, so to speak, or, you know, effectively loop.
I mean, in practice, you want to limit that in case, you know, something happens. You don't want to lose, you know, whatever's running on there. But we can test how far, how stable it is.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah.
And as you said, as Justin mentioned, this was mentioned by the committee to Chip. It was this question to Chip, right, about the JLab farm using virtualization.
Yeah, and I think that for the lattice it made no sense, but we're not lattice either. So.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the lattice, it's sort of equivalent to changing your trigger farm, your software trigger farm, to running a cloud instance. You could, instead of whatever it takes to switch the lattice clusters over to physics, you could just say on these set of lattice nodes, I want to launch my cloud instance. And I'll just deploy my virtual machines to that that cloud setup. Mm-hmm. So it's just a different way of doing things.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, then we'll plan on going ahead if there's no objections.
Yeah. I think all this information is great because there'll be a lot to assimilate at the end of this challenge.
Okay, so go back to the main agenda then. Any questions for Justin, though, before we completely leave the topic? One piece of news before we get to item five, the schedule, is that I talked to Chris Lariou in Scientific Computing. Remember, there was an effort to develop workflow tools. By Scientific Computing for use by nuclear physics here. And that effort has gone forward, but it's been a bit, its pace has slowed down. They've lost one of their programmers, one of their staff members, and jobs have been shifted around, and Chris has been kind of pulled off of that onto more operational type things in the last little while. So that is not gone forward as fast as we had hoped, and He didn't think that he would have anything ready for us to use for this particular data challenge. So we're going to have to, you know, go it alone again for the JLab end of things. I thought I should mention that. I did talk to him about that. Okay.
You've talked to him about us running the data challenge. Maybe in general, just to tell him that we are in. To show that we're interested, it might be worth just inviting him to these meetings while we're running them, as we're getting ready, just to show that there is actual
That's
need.
A good idea. That's a good idea. I'll do that. He is really interested in what our working style is, and he has really no clue, you know.
And this should come from
So that's a good suggestion. I think he'd be very interested in coming.
Okay.
Let's see. Okay, so Curtis wrote down a schedule here under item 5.
Just made it up.
It's good. It's good. Launch a data challenge on Thursday, February 27th, 2:15 in the afternoon. And
I didn't run the time, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, sorry, my bad.
Estimate.
Test jobs going successfully by Tuesday, February 25th. Distribution ready by Monday, February 24th. Okay, so it's a schedule. It's a deadline. That sounds fine. It's far enough away that we will all agree to that and only object when it gets close. No, but it's a good thing to have.
No, you've got to have an idea of when you think you want to do something or it just slips.
Yeah, and that's consistent with what we've told the computer center as well. In fact, I probably saw this before I spoke to them. So, does anyone have any comment on the proposed schedule? Okay, so I think the outstanding action items are K on the the genealogy. On the electromagnetic background, I think we still want to look at what is useful. Okay, since we're paying a big time price, processing-wise, I think we should do something at that high CPU per event cost. Certainly.
Yeah.
Okay. Exactly what kind of depends. So one fine-tuning there is what kind of, I think 10 to the 7th, we're going to have to go to the low side, and I don't think we can usefully go lower than 10 to the 7th. So that seems like to be a good rate. So, I mean, these are all arguable points. The other thing is exactly what is the useful gate that gives us, you know, it dirties up the events in a realistic way. I'm not quite sure exactly how to answer that question. Whether we just do it by seat of the pants, the drift chamber gates, or something more sophisticated.
If we go by the drift chamber gates, we need to use the -400 kind of range, 800 nanoseconds or something like that.
Right, but we need to go later, right?
Yeah, need to go later, yeah.
So you got to go minus something to positive 800.
Yeah.
Minus 200, 800 or something.
Yeah. Which just makes it worse.
Well, I mean, there's also a question of, you don't know how much of that really late stuff is even going to impact anything in your. I don't know.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. There may be at some point where you're so late that it's less and so. Right. Exactly. So the cutoff may not be a hard 800.
Yeah.
That's what I was saying. It might be more sophisticated than that, but I don't really know how to judge that.
Not obvious we can do it before this challenge. Maybe we should, but it's basically running a certain number of events with various gates and reconstructing them and seeing, trying to understand details of the reconstruction. Where does it stop mattering?
Right.
Yeah. Tricky.
Okay. Okay, then.
We have this bigger problem of trying to, checking the tag version to make sure that we've got something sensible, and then this memory, if it really is a memory issue.
Okay, so we have to look at these failures and try to figure out. That's really the top priority right now.
Yeah.
So I will certainly sit down with Simon and show him what I'm getting. It sounds very much like what Paul's getting. So
yeah.
At least the tagging works. At least we're running the exact same crap, you know.
We have consistent crap.
Maybe crap, but at least it's consistent. Okay. And what else is the big action item here?
It's the phi equals zero issue.
Oh yeah, the phi equals zero issue. Okay. Crashes and gate setting. And beyond that,
the random number, I think it's in there, but somebody needs to check it and just make sure.
Oh yeah, the random number is a big one. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
David would know the most.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else for today?
No.
Okay. Good. We're adjourned.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you. Please stand by.